Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming right up, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour with news, views, reviews, and interviews from the underground. At 10 o'clock on the Food Show, members of the Northwest Veg talk about vegetarianism in Oregon, and the Food Show Collective presents a provocative parlay with the proprietors of Portland's preeminent packer of premium pickles. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner says a military operation has already begun inside Iran, and he discusses what he calls the unprecedented revolt against Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld within the military. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Well, guess what, comrades? We are moles in the ground. As for me, I'm proud of it. Especially Monday mornings, Old Mole Time on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, non-commercial, listener-supported, independent radio. The Old Mole begins Monday's KBOO's Monday Radio Zine, its magazine of the air. KBOO's membership drive ended, and successfully last week. We want to thank all the people who pledged, especially those who renewed and became new members during the Old Mole Variety Hour. We want to invite all you folks, new members and old, to come down here to investigate the ways you can become radioactive. KBOO is one of those many organizations in U.S. life that defies top-down corporate-style hierarchy. KBOO is democratic, owned and managed by its members and workers. We make policy and do the work and gain the great pleasure and fulfillment of participating in the decisions that shape our lives. There's so many things you can do and learn here at KBOO, routine organizational stuff, radio's technical side, and radio production, too. It's real easy to start doing short pieces on the news. And for those who want to tell their stories, their good stories, especially about work, and, of course, challenging the boss and demonstrating in the words of the Wobblies that the boss's brains are under the workers' hats. If you want to share your stories about work with all of us, leave a message for the Old Mole at KBOO, and we'll help you put it together and to make mole radio. Today on the Mole, like every Monday, we try to explore the contending forces in this country and world, especially those ever-reigniting struggles from below. Today we look at democracy, especially how we can reconstruct electoral systems and what would be the conditions of real democracy. I first talked to Janice Thompson and Charlie Burr of the Money and Politics Research Project about Portland's embattled system of voter-owned elections. Then we hear from Bob Ritchie from the national organization Fair Vote. Then comes old mole Fran Michelle doing a well-read read on, yes, it's April 17th, taxes. And the show continues with Jerry Levin, who did the book West Bank Diary, Middle East Violence, as reported by a former American hostage. He's here in Portland now. He's going to be speaking in Portland and Vancouver this coming week. And the show concludes with Jason Scheckler discussing challenges to the Carpenters Union, both from non-union wage-coming firms and in coming to terms with immigration and the many people around the world desperate for work. That's all engineered by Tammy Dean and all on today's Old Mole. First on the Mole, welcome Janice Thompson and Charlie Burr.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us on, Bill.
Both of you folks are with the Money and Politics Research Action Project and friends of voter-owned election. Janice, why don't you start?
Sure.
Tell us about your group, your work.
Right. Well, as an organization, the Money and Politics Research Action Project tracks political money and advocates for campaign finance reform, and we were involved in promoting Portland's voter-owned elections really from the very beginning, and really want to just jump to pointing out to folks the very fundamental change we're already seeing in the way campaigns are occurring in our city. Right now, in the primary, instead of dialing for dollars, we've got voter-owned candidates who are engaging the public and limiting the cost of their campaigns. One candidate, Dan Saltzman, who was a VOE supporter, is voluntarily limiting his contributions, which really would not be occurring without the presence of this system. He's facing a viable opponent, very atypical for incumbents to really face significant challengers. And this opponent is running a strong and viable challenge, really based on part because of the greater or the more level playing field provided by voter-owned elections. Eric Sten is running as a voter-owned candidate, and in that race is really preventing it from becoming a fundraising arms race that it would be without voter-owned elections. And I think in his case, we're really seeing the opportunities for a grassroots campaign to take on moneyed folks. So,
although his opponent, Jenny Burdick, apparently has rejected voter-owned election money and is trying to raise money from the people who have the big money.
Right, right. One of the key things is to really contrast this with kind of what, you know, it's to really clarify how broken and unfair the old system was. So, for example, in the last election cycle in 2004, almost 70% of the city campaign contributions came from only 7% of the donors in checks of 1,000 or more. Most or a significant
really, 70% came from
right.
The big guys.
Right.
Yeah, large
right.
Checks of $1,000 or more.
Exactly. And so that's what we're really seeing differently. What's really interesting, there was a failed repeal effort. Those folks may be back, but the likes of Portland General Electric, Quest, Portland Business Alliance, Garden Gerber.
It was extraordinary. These guys were trying to repeal voter-owned elections. The richest companies, mm-hmm. including the Oregonian in this town, are against the voter-owned elections, I guess because they owned the elections before that.
Yeah, it seems pretty clear. I mean,
yeah.
PGE, Quest, other special interests, Garden Gerber, where Jenny Burdick actually works,
uh-huh.
It's clear that this new system that they don't like, it reduces and limits their power. But for voters, it puts voters at the center of these elections. They actually have a chance to run viable races, become genuinely involved. And the old system was broken. It did favor incumbents. It favored big money candidates. And if you look back over the past 35 years, only 5 incumbents have ever lost under the old big money system. That's why we enacted this change. And there were scores of grassroots organizations who lobbied for this change, people like the League of Women Voters of Portland, MIPREP, Oregon Action, grassroots organizations representing tens of thousands of voters pushed to create a more open, fair, and accountable system.
Mm-hmm. You know, recently, of course, the scandal was uncovered about the system. It seems to me what it reflects, though, is that the way the system was set up really worked well. That is, the people who were able to get 1,000 signatures and $5 a person were people who actually were involved in the community deeply, were involved in networks, had real support. And the people who had it looks like bend the law, maybe break the law, whatever it is that they did, really didn't have that broad support, were not able to do it, and tried to do it, who knows, in shady
right.
ways.
Right.
We'll find that out, how shady.
Yeah, the allegations.
Tell us about that.
Well, the allegations, if proven, are violations of the current law. And
Give us the background, Janice. What were the allegations? What happened briefly?
That people weren't really signing for themselves. And they weren't really giving $5. I mean, both just blatant violations. And
Right, sort of engineered by a guy behind the scenes who...
Well, that's part of the allegation. Right. I mean, so, you know, any system is going to have these kind of startup issues. This is no different. They were caught, you know, with an investigation called for originally by the League of Women Voters. There needs to be an active investigation, some maybe additional safeguards included. But the really important thing is to not lose sight that voter-owned elections is already reducing the cost of campaigns and overall creating a really open and level playing field for candidates. And one of the things is that it's also kind of a proven reform in Maine and Arizona, where folks have had the greatest experience with this. Some occasional problems have occurred there. Similarly to here, they were caught right away with people being prosecuted and forced to return
money. Yeah, in Arizona, some people would get on the ballot, get the public money, and then spend it on parties. But those people were caught. It becomes real clear.
Right, and it also needs to be clarified that that was, you know, two or three people out of hundreds of candidates.
Right.
So it's a small subset of folks, and the whole system is indeed set up to be caught. And the other
in Maine too, right? The publicly funded elections has just led to so many more interesting candidates, people who couldn't run before, and it's changed the electoral outcomes too in Arizona and Maine, is my understanding, at least on the local level.
Yeah, it's really taken off. At the state level in Arizona, with 10 out of the 11 statewide candidates elected under the new system.
Really?
Yeah.
10 out of 11.
And growing legislative use. Lots. The legislature in Maine, and one of the key things is to really kind of take a look at it, at how it's affecting public policy really in cost-effective ways. The first governor down in Arizona, Janet Napolitano, elected under the system, was able to keep her campaign promise to sign an executive order relating to bulk purchasing of prescription drugs by state agencies. One of the first things she did. She hadn't had to take campaign contributions from pharmaceutical companies. In Maine, the legislature there has adopted a very innovative health care plan that a guest from Maine who came to testify really attributed to the voter-owned election system in place there. I mean, that the legislature could take on the pharmaceutical insurance companies and address the needs of people rather than special interests. And that's what I think we're going to see in Portland with folks being really elected in different kinds of ways. Really want to mention that the repeal effort may resurface, and we're actively looking for folks to sign on as endorsers and help us out in any number of ways. Please go to friendsofvoe.org. Write letters to the editor. You mentioned the Oregonian, which has been quite vehement in their opposition. So always looking for folks to join the letter to the editor team. We're trying to get house parties, pledge parties going. Friendsofvoe.org is where I'd like to suggest people to go.
Yeah, I think Janice is absolutely right. The opponents, people like PG&E, Quest, Garden Gerber, the Oregon Restaurant Association, people who really benefited from the old system are still out to attack and dismantle this system. They just spent $350,000 on paid petition gatherers.
And failed
to get it on the ballot. But I think they've wasted little time in exploiting these startup issues. And I think
that's
people,
a pittance for them, of course.
Pennies on the dollar. Yeah. But I think people see it for what it is. That these are special interests who understand that this system is limiting their own power and influence and opening it up for greater opportunity for a more diverse, wide array of citizens to actually meaningfully get involved in the process. But ultimately, it's not going to be the Oregonian editorial board, Garden Gerber, and PGE who are going to sign this. It's going to be everyday voters who are going to see that this system really does create a more open and fair chance for them to be heard. So,
Janice Thompson and Charlie Burr, thanks a lot, but before we sign off, let's again repeat the ways in which people can get in touch with you and support the public financing of election, voter-owned elections?
Go to two options. One is to go to the website, friendsofvoe.org, or you can give us a call, 503-283-1922. But we're looking for help in any number of ways, letters to the editor, house parties, leafleting at, you know, forums and events kind of during the upcoming election season and through the summer.
Those are the main ones. If you want to help out, we'd love to get you involved. And it's a great system. It is working. The startup issues involved here we take seriously. But going forward, this is a fair and open system. This is going to create more opportunity for people. But we're going to have to fight for it. There are special interests who want to dismantle it, but we're not going to let them.
Thanks a lot for being here. We were going to talk to Bob Ritchie right after this interview, but apparently the phone connection failed. That happens. So what we're going to do, I believe, Tammy, is Bob on the line? Oh, good. The phone connection has been restored. Terrific. That was quick work. Thank you. Thank you very much, Janice Thompson and Charlie Burr.
Thanks, Bill, for the opportunity to come in.
And thanks for having us on.
And now we'll go to Bob Ritchie. Bob, are you there in Tacoma Park, Maryland?
I am. Thank you, Bill. I'm pleased to have a chance to be on the program.
Good. Tell us about Fair Vote, the organization which you're the director. What's the mission of Fair Vote? What's wrong with the, as they call it, our world's oldest democracy? What would Fair Vote do to fix that?
Right. Well, it's an old democracy, which is great, but it does get pretty creaky sometimes when you don't ever change some of the key structures and rules that one has as part of a democracy. And, you know, Tom Paine, 200 years ago, pointed out that the institutional rules that govern elections are often the last things to change when innovations happen, and which can be quite different with technology and things. You know, we now drive cars and fly planes, but we still have the Electoral College and don't have a right to vote in the Constitution and use single-member districts to try to represent complex populations. And we have a vision of democracy, which we call the way democracy will be. We have confidence that we can change a lot of these rules, and our basic goal is to establish the principle that every voter should have an equally protected and meaningful vote in when they're getting a chance to vote for the offices they care about, like president and Congress and so on. And there's several obstacles to that, and that's where we support change. And some people may know us from our former name, which is the Center for Voting and Democracy. We've been around for several years, and we support instant runoff voting, proportional representation, right to vote in the Constitution, and a national popular vote for president are sort of our core issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a big issue, of course, about voting machines and just counting the most basic question of electoral systems. I gather you're not so involved in that one. There's lots of organizations that are. You're involved primarily in the larger questions of the structure of the electoral systems and how those structures now are so skewed to so limit people's participation and so limit the range of issues that can be discussed.
I think that's fair to say, and I would say that on the issues of protecting our vote is that one of the basic problems is that we do it in a very haphazard, localized, inefficient, poorly regulated way. We often privatize our democracy by basically contracting out with private companies how to run elections, and they are not necessarily doing a very good job, and it's poorly regulated and so on. So we think that's rooted in the fact that we actually never established a constitutional right to vote, and we never established protections of it in the way that is where most modern democracies do. And you can see a lot of problems flowing from that. But we don't get involved in the daily, you know, battles going on in legislatures on paper trails.
Right. Although that's an important thing to do. It's just not...
But there's other groups doing it.
Right. There's a lot of other groups doing it, and it is important. Let's talk about the way in which the current electoral systems have led to voting rates that are now plunging below 50%, and in many elections they're below 25%. Why are people so turned off, and what's wrong with the system?
Well, I think that we just often don't have the full spectrum of choices and the belief in the candidates that inspire participation. I think we not only have low turnout, but we have incredible disparities in who votes based on educational background and income and so on. And that's, in some ways, even worse, the fact that, we'll have wealthy people voting at turnout rates, three times higher than poor people and so on, which is something that even if a country has relatively low turnout, they typically don't have that kind of disparity. And I think that's partly because of the kinds of candidates that run and the issues that they talk about. And for us, that's tied to the rules, because if you have winner-take-all elections and to run and win, you need to have at least 50% of the vote. You'll have some constituencies, you'll have some districts where, people run who are incredibly good candidates, and that's great. But you'll have a lot of places where they don't, that they either aren't taken seriously because they're seen as people who can't get 50%, or in their struggle to get 50%, they start ejecting some of their principles or some of the things they care about because they think it's dangerous to talk about them. And at the end of the day, we often end up with one or two choices that are seen as credible. And so you just don't have the range of debate that we need and the kind of the range of means to get access to participating. Like a young person getting involved in politics, often will be looking for someone they believe is authentic, that really sort of seems true and exciting and speaks about issues that need to be spoken about, and they just too often don't find someone. Even if they're good people, they don't perceive them that way, and that can lead to patterns of non-participation that go on for generations, or mm-hmm. decades at least.
Yeah, what's fundamental to, I think, KABU and our listening audience, and certainly the Old Mole Collective, is that alternative voices, because of the winner-take-all system, and because people think, God, I better vote for X, even though I don't like X, who's not nearly as dangerous as Y. So you go for the lesser evil. And what it means is that the alternative parties, particularly progressive parties here, either the Socialists or the Pacific Green Party, in fact, people think it's too expensive to vote for who they really want, or even to listen to them. And in fact, so therefore, in at least electoral seasons, those alternative parties are just not heard, and the whole message and critique then doesn't get heard. And my sense is there are electoral systems that would make sure that in fact those people were really part and a creative part of the system, like IRV and maybe
right.
fusion voting. Why don't we talk about that a little?
Sure. Well, instant runoff voting is definitely one of our core beliefs of a way that we should vote. It's a system that you use within winner-take-all elections, so it's still a winner-take-all system. But one way to think about it is that it's not an all-or-nothing system. You have more to say than just one thing. So that if you support someone who you suspect may not win, or at least the general perception is that they won't, some independent or third party perhaps, or a challenging progressive
voice. May not win this election, yes.
Right. And that shouldn't be the threshold for why they should participate in politics, though, because they can present new ideas, and it's good for our politics to have fuller debate and so on. But right now, a lot of people will say, well, gosh, why are you running? You can't win. You're just a spoiler. Well, instant runoff voting, the idea is that you shouldn't be able to win a one-winner office like governor or mayor with less than half the votes, because you should be as representative as possible, and winning a majority is one way to measure that. And if you're winning with, say, 40%, it means 60% voted for, at least two other candidates, and somehow the vote divided in a way that you finished on the top with 40. And instant runoff is a way to measure whether you really actually were the majority candidate or not. What you do is you simulate a two-round runoff so that you, in the first round, you indicate your first choice, and then you count up all the first choices, and whoever is, the strong candidates is at the top of the heap. But you've also said who your second and third choices are. And if your first choice was a weak candidate, someone who finishes third or with maybe 10, 15% or something, you're not done yet, because if no one has a majority yet, we need to determine who that majority winner is, and so your ballot counts for your next choice among the strong candidates. So if it's something like 45-40-15, and you vote for someone who has 15% support, that candidate loses. No one has a majority yet, though, and your ballot counts for whoever's listed second.
Right.
And it'll be like 55-45 or something.
Right.
Like
in a practical sense, and let's say the Portland area, if we had instant runoff voting, people could vote for the Green Party first. The Socialist Party would be their next choice, and who knows who else, and maybe the Democratic Party would be their third choice in order to make sure that a real rabid right-winger doesn't win.
The voter would have that option.
Right. You would be recording your real choices, and at some point, and those people then, the alternative parties of the left and the right, in fact, would have an opportunity to actually be part of the deliberation process and a meaningful part within the electoral system.
Right, and that major party candidate has to be fully accountable, because if they're only a big supportive candidate or with, getting substantial percentages of the vote because of the suppression of choice for others, this will be a way to show that. Now, I think typically most major party candidates can earn that support they have, but we should make sure they can. And, for instance, Burlington, Vermont is the biggest city in Vermont, and they just use instant runoff voting for mayor. They've had there's a third party there called the Progressive Party, which has had some real success. Bernie Sanders was mayor of Burlington. And but there was a Democrat who was seen as the big front runner candidate. It was an open seat for mayor. She was seen as the strongest candidate. She outspent the whole field by at least 5-1. But she really wasn't a very strong candidate, or she wasn't a very, at the end of the day, she didn't have very substantive positions. Because they had instant runoff voting and this kind of free range of choice, this Progressive Party candidate, who was a state legislator, decided to jump in, 9 weeks out from the vote, because he felt that she was being a weak candidate. Voters ultimately agreed, and he finished first in the first choice count and won on the instant runoff count. And it just was a more accountable race. She had to face real competition. She didn't just get to kind of run off against a lesser of two evils Republican, and she turned out not to be someone who was a strong enough candidate to win. Now, that's sort of a way to measure accountability, too, that I think is important.
Mm-hmm. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, 90.7 FM, on cable radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Bob Ritchie of the national organization Fair Vote. We're talking about electoral systems that actually give people, that create much larger debates, that really help alternative parties get involved in alternative ideas. We've talked about instant runoff voting. Bob Ritchie, I guess we wanted to talk about instant runoff voting versus fusion things. I don't think there's going to be time. We're going to have to conclude, but I want to ask you one.
Can I just say a quick word on that, though, Bill?
Sure.
Just a quick word, which is that fusion is also used out there. We're seeing a rise of instant runoff voting. The key thing for, I think, people to compare the concepts is that with fusion, you have other parties on the ballot, but the candidate who wins, there still can be the spoiler dynamic. So if those small parties run their own candidate, then you're
right.
You're back to the spoiler dynamic. So there's a way to kind of make the current choice system work better. But I don't think it transforms politics in the way that I'd like to see. So it's sort of what I see as like a complement to instant runoff voting,
right.
But not a replacement for it. Also, Oregon's debating this top two primary system, and I would just urge people to look at instant runoff voting and proportional voting as an alternative to that, because that'll preserve real choices in November, while the proposal being put forward would not do that.
And instant runoff voting, it's being adopted all over the country. I'm afraid we can't get into that, but for people who do want to get into it, Google Fair Vote, and you'll get it. They're number one on the Google list, Fair Vote. Bob Ritchie, one last thing. You're not only, it seems to me, Fair Vote is also focusing on one of their major things is the larger social, the way the society is structured to turn people off. And electoral institutions are just one of the ways that people participate. And in fact, if they don't really participate in daily life, if the issues are not live to people, if they don't develop habits of participation, if in fact the society is so top down that they just turn off from all authority, including the electoral bosses, it seems to me you don't get real elections and you don't have democracy. Give us real briefly a sense of how do we build an actual grassroots democracy with a lot of direct participation so that people develop those habits.
Well, as you would suspect, there's no magic bullet to achieve that laudable, necessary goal. But I guess what I think one thing is important is to keep the big vision out there and to keep working for it. And here's just one quick example. You know, a lot of people have been against the Electoral College. We've been against the Electoral College because we talked about it and looked at what's wrong with what it does to our politics and making, you know, some states where the candidates spend all their time and most of the states where they don't spend a dime and don't care what anyone thinks. And that's just wrong. We were able to embrace a proposal, be ready to embrace a proposal that's now really taking off. This is this national popular vote plan where states can join together collectively to establish a national popular vote. And I think that kind of came out of thinking big and then looking for local and state applications. And actually all of the things that we support, we keep looking for local applications, and all of them do. And there's some really neat things, like, you know, Portland has pushed forward with trying to change the campaign finance system, and so, you know, that we keep can make things work better at a local level and keep working up, but keep the big picture in mind,
right?
Because that often can help inform things we can do.
Rob Ritchie, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill.
At Fair Vote. Thank you. And next on the Old Mole, we have Fran Michelle, an Old Mole Collective member, doing her well-read read on Yes, It's 2 days after April 15th. It's tax day, and Fran Michelle comments.
Like a lot of you, the well-read Red has been thinking about taxes. Many of us are particularly distressed that we're paying for the war in Iraq, which by September will have cost not only countless thousands of lives, but also $315 billion. There's a long American tradition of refusing to pay for injustice. Most famously, in the 1840s, Henry David Thoreau refused to pay his federal poll tax because of his objections to slavery and to the war against Mexico. He described his reasons in the 1849 essay, Resistance to Civil Government, also known as Civil Disobedience, where he noted that, under a government which imprisons unjustly, the true place for a just citizen is also a prison. Tax resistance today does not generally lead to imprisonment, though the IRS may eventually collect by seizing wages or property. Others avoid paying taxes by keeping their income below the tax threshold. Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, hasn't paid taxes in over 25 years. More information and strategies for war tax resistance can be found through the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. Their website is at www.nwtrcc.org. And there are, of course, other problems with the current tax system and other solutions being proposed. Last week, the website us.oneworld.net reported on environmental tax reform. Several nations, particularly in Europe, have recently lowered income taxes by increasing levies on air, water, and soil pollution, the sorts of things traditional economists tend to refer to as externalities. Such reforms have enabled Germany, for instance, to reduce fuel use and to increase job creation in renewable energy sectors. In the U.S., there are other more obvious problems. Gar Alperovitz, writing last week on TomPaine.com, observes that it's no secret that the Bush administration has showered high-income groups with federal tax benefits, nor is it news that income and wealth is highly concentrated at the top. What have gone largely unnoticed, however, are new signs that outside of Washington, state by state, the public is quietly beginning to challenge the privileged position of those at the top. The United States is the most inequitable advanced nation in the world. Every year since 1996, the top 1% has garnered more income than the bottom 100 million Americans taken together. Wealth ownership is even more concentrated than income. The top 1% of wealth holders owns roughly half of all financial and business wealth. The top 5% owns almost 70% of such wealth. In 2003, the top 1% alone received 57.5% of all capital gains, rent, interest, and dividend income, up from 37.6% 2 decades earlier. A recent analysis by the New York Times and Citizens for Tax Justice found that 43% of the Bush dividend tax cuts went to taxpayers with incomes greater than $1 million, who make up a mere one-tenth of 1% of all taxpayers. This extraordinary situation is bad not only for those at the bottom of the economic pyramid, but for the nation as a whole. Historically, huge political power regularly follows huge wealth, with disastrous implications for democracy. Signs of growing public concern over the wealthy not paying their fair share can be found just beneath the radar of media attention in many parts of the country. Commonly, state tax practices follow and are linked to federal practices in numerous specific areas, but states are increasingly decoupling their tax regulations from the federal approach, that is, electing not to follow federal practices. For instance, 18 states and the District of Columbia have decoupled from one of the largest modern corporate giveaways, the so-called federal production activities deduction. 31 states have decoupled from a related corporate tax break, the bonus depreciation charges of 2002 and 3. New Jersey has gone further and imposed taxes on those making more than $500,000, using proceeds to offset property taxes that fall disproportionately on the middle and lower classes. In 2004, California voters overwhelmingly approved tax increases for people making above $1 million, with the proceeds earmarked for mental health programs. A follow-on initiative this year will propose taxes on the top 1%, individuals making more than $400,000 a year, and couples making more than $800,000, to pay for quality preschool for all four-year-olds. Even in red state Virginia, the state Senate approved special taxes on those making more than $100,000 and $150,000 in 2004. Tennessee and New Hampshire have special taxes on interest and dividends, which fall mainly on those making more than $100,000. There have even been some grassroots stirring directed at taxing wealth, not simply income. Florida is currently the only state with a modest intangible tax on stocks, bonds, and other wealth, a provision of law which Governor Jeb Bush opposes, but so far has been unsuccessful in abolishing. Progressive policy think tanks in two states have put forward much bolder strategies. In Washington, the Economic Opportunity Institute has proposed a 0.5% tax on wealth, which, after exempting the first $1 million, would yield $477 million in annual revenue. The New Jersey Policy Perspective Group has proposed 0.25% financial assets tax levied on those with financial holdings in excess of $2 million. That is, only about 35,000 top asset holders statewide. What's politically intriguing about these various strategies is not simply that they target the rich. It is that they do not divide the middle class politically from low and moderate income Americans. Unlike taxes that hit the suburban 20% to generate benefits for lower income groups, such strategies put the bottom 95 to 97% on one side of the political divide, with only a very small elite being targeted. Driving all this, of course, is the search for new financial resources in an era of growing fiscal pain at all levels. The federal income tax, which once seemed as unlikely as some of the currently emerging elite income and wealth tax proposals, became law after a long buildup of concern and political initiative around the country. If the social and economic pain continues to build, and if America's financial elites continue to garner such huge shares of the nation's economic resources for themselves, we may well begin to see more far-reaching state and even federal changes than most observers currently imagine possible. Again, that's Gar Alperovitz, writing in TomPaine.com. For the Well-Read Red, this has been Fran Michel.
Thanks to Fran Michel. Again, this is your Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon. Two interviews are upcoming on the Old Mole. The second is with Jason Scheckler, a carpenter. We're going to talk about the attack by non-union wage-cutting firms and also how to deal with the question of immigration. In the studio now, let me welcome you, Sis Levin and Jerry Levin. Jerry's the, you did it together, I'm sure. Jerry is the titled author of the book West Bank Diary, Middle East Violence, as reported by a former American hostage. Tell us, we only have a few minutes. You're in town now, and you're going to be speaking a couple times. We'll announce when. Tell us and when your biography is written in real brief form in Wikipedia, the progressive online website, encyclopedia. How would you write it? What would you say about yourself and your lives?
Well, in a nutshell, I would say I'm a former mainstream journalist who left mainstream journalism in order to go to Palestine to tell the story that is not always reported as nearly as well as it needs to be with respect to the terrible occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people. I've felt their pain and suffering very deeply, especially because my ethnicity. I was born Jewish. I have become a Christian. And I feel that what is taking place in Palestine is unconscionable. It's fine for my people, the Jewish people, to need to have a safe place to stay, but not at the expense of other people.
And I am a Southern Christian who fell madly in love with, still I am, a Yankee Jew, and went to a mostly Muslim country when Jerry was Middle East bureau chief for CNN, found himself kidnapped and held hostage for a year, which I wrote about in my book. And
well, what was your book? I'm sorry.
My book was Beirut Diary, which sold out the entire first edition and paid for my doctorate in education. My belief is that while you guys are talking about all the bad news, the good news is that the children are not buying into this, and they deserve better than this. And with the right kind of trained teachers and materials, we can look at what's called education for peace, and they prefer it, and they absorb it, and it will be a better world. But we've got to learn how to do it.
Right. That education for peace is not, of course, being passive. It's being active but nonviolent. Is that
good for you?
Yes.
It is creative, active, nonviolent. But it has to be learned. And the teachers have to be trained to do it. Teachers have been told make a good grade on a test is all that is necessary. And so we do not have progressive education. And we have epidemic violence in our schools, both abroad and here. And as I said, children have a right to a better education than that.
So
and the world will change when we do learn to do that.
You're doing education work on the West Bank.
I am in Bethlehem.
Right, with Palestinian, with lots and lots of Palestinians.
Well, the first year I worked in Israel, per se. But
really?
When we went into Iraq, the money for education in Israeli schools for teacher training was removed. Everything went to the military. So I moved under occupation, also with the idea that under military, brutal military occupation, to see students choose the creative, nonviolent path dries up the few that are inclined to do suicide bombing, for instance.
Right.
They also went to the West Bank because Israel, the Arabs in Israel, have a terrible civil rights problem. We know that. They're fifth-class citizens. In the West Bank, however, the Palestinians, the Arabs under occupation, have a terrible human rights problem. And so she went where the worst oppression is taking
place. But they had quite wonderful schools, and they're scoring higher than Israeli schools, which
really
is very interesting as an educator to look
at. And they've maintained themselves. I guess they're very local schools, since people can barely move in the West Bank. You have to go very near your home and learn.
Well, particularly Bethlehem, which is enclosed in the wall.
Right. You folks are going to be speaking three times in the next couple of days in this area, in Salem tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Jason Lee United Methodist Church. That's tomorrow.
PowerPoint projection presentation.
Oh, good. All the latest from In Portland on Wednesday at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, that's also at 7 p.m., right. That's at 147 Northwest 19th, Trinity Episcopal Cathedral. And in Vancouver, you're going to be at Thursday at 2:50 p.m. at the Washington State University, the Vancouver campus, at the Multimedia Center. So people, again, at Salem on tomorrow at the United Methodist Church at 7, Portland Wednesday at the Trinity Episcopal Cathedral, and Thursday at Washington State at 2:50 p.m., Washington State, the Vancouver campus. Jerry Levin, I guess CIS has a lot of hope. You, in fact, see, you've really reported on what the Israelis are doing in the West Bank. Your dispatches actually are on the web. If you just Google Jerry Levin, in fact, you'll
find... If somebody wants to receive my dispatches called From the Inside Looking Out, you can Google me, and my email is jlevin0320@yahoo.com, jlevin0320@yahoo.com, and I'll send them to you.
Right, or your book, West Bank Diary.
Right.
What's the basis for... You're thinking that things can be changed. How do we stop the Israelis, and how, in fact, do we force them to actually negotiate and talk to Hamas?
The road to peace in the Middle East is through Washington, D.C. Nothing will change. Nothing will change. It's not up to Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely
not up to Hamas.
Right.
Yes.
Nothing will change until our series of U.S. governments does a complete about-face. I don't see that happening anytime soon. We can hope and we can pray for it. But meanwhile, today for the Palestinians is worse than yesterday. Tomorrow will be worse than today until Washington becomes an honest broker, which it has not been for over 40 years.
CIS Levin, Jerry Levin, Beirut Diaries, CIS wrote... Jerry Levin's West Bank Diary.
Mine became a movie. Marlo Thomas, which
really?
Is still available and is very helpful for the Middle East for dummies who really need to know who the players are, why they are doing this, and what our terrible role in it is.
And you're going to be talking about those very things at these three talks in the Portland area.
Mm-hmm. The title is The Peace Process, spelled P-I-E-C-E, continues, The Struggle Against Myths, Propaganda, Violence, and Annexation in the West Bank.
And the complete futility of violence both here and there.
Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
That was CIS Levin and Jerry Levin speaking in the area. If you want to learn more about it, you can call KABU if you didn't copy down their speaking locations, and it'll be at the front desk. Last on the Old Mole today, let me welcome Jason Scheckler.
Hello.
He's a man of good words. Jason Scheckler is now working for the Carpenters Union as an organizer. For many years, he was a really committed rank-and-file organizer at every rally, labor rally and social justice globalization rally. He had spirit and determination, a wonderful militant rank-and-file worker, and, in fact, intellectual. Jason Scheckler, welcome to KABU.
Hello.
Let's first talk about the Benson Towers thing. We're going to do two interviews, basically. Okay. One on Benson Towers, the other one on immigration.
Okay.
Tell us about Benson Towers.
Okay. Well, I pretty much have to start from the beginning of the Benson Tower because a lot of people aren't familiar with what happened. But what happened was the Benson Tower was being built in Portland, Oregon, and to bring in a non-union contractor from Canada, they made claims that local construction workers, particularly local carpenters, weren't skilled enough to build the Benson Tower.
Really? Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they brought this non-union Canadian company in, and this company actually needed to hire some workers. They didn't have a big enough crew, so they started hiring in the paper, and that's when the Carpenters Union had some people salt the job. And
you worked there for a while, didn't you?
So I was one of the salts there for about a month and a half, and there was many safety violations. We had to fight to even have a safety handrail up, and then when we started to come out union, starting wearing union stickers on our hard hats, they fired one of us, which forced us to have to go out on strike to defend our union brother, which shut down the job for 3 days. All the other trades walked, and caused ITC, the general contractor, to fire the sub concrete finish contractor, LaRusso Concrete, and hire another non-union one, working to make the job even more non-union than it already was.
Why is it so important to maintain union to force them to hire union contractors? It's basically the last outpost of the Carpenters Union, right? A lot of residential construction is now non-union. It's really important to maintain that core of the big building.
Yes, high rises aren't usually built with non-union carpenters in the city of Portland. So this is basically the beginning of these developers seeing if they can use non-union labor to see how it would go to build a building. That's why this is on the forefront of organizing for the building trades. We need to nip this right now before it grows.
And what's true of carpenters will then be true of pipe fitters and everybody else. Electricians, well, maybe not electricians. They'll be the last ones.
Well, actually, the plumbers on that job are also non-union.
Really, the plumbers are non-union?
The plumbers are non-union, and the glazers, the glass workers are non-union. The plumbers actually recently had their license in Oregon revoked for using non-union plumbers, which is against the law.
How are you doing? There's a series of actions. You have another one coming up on the 26th, is it?
Yeah. In a new coalition that we're part of, the Change the Wind Coalition, there's a week of action. And on the 26th, it will Wednesday at 11:30 on the 26th is the action in front of the Benson Tower. We've had a series of different actions.
Where is the Benson Tower? Tell us that.
The Benson Tower is located on 11th and Clay in southwest Portland.
Mm-hmm.
We've had many actions there before at around lunchtime. Lunchtime rallies with the other union workers from nearby job sites.
And how does the week begin?
The week of action?
Yeah.
I can't speak to the other union struggles in there. I can just speak to the carpenters one right now. I don't know what information they want out right now.
Okay. 11:30 on the 26th then at the Benson Tower.
Yeah, at 11th and Clay.
It's a really important struggle. Jason Scheckler, this is KABU Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Jason Scheckler, You've been a rank-and-file militant, involved in all sorts of struggles over the years, particularly with Jobs with Justice and the Cross-Border Labor Organizing Committee and PCASC, the Central America Solidarity Committee. The immigration issue is now heating up, and I wonder if you could talk about it from the, not as a carpenter, I know that you're not authorized as the carpenter's representative. Tell us about your experiences and how working people and carpenters, you know, tradespeople, all of the people you meet, it seems to me there's tremendous sort of differences of opinion and problems in coming to terms with the immigration question. Tell us about how you see it.
Well, first off, I'd like to say that what's happening right now with the movement for immigration reform is actually a workers' movement. This is coming from people that have been mistreated in this country, not had the same rights to organize as the rest of the workers in this country. And I think the picture's a lot bigger than what a lot of workers say. Even some militant workers continue to blame the worker for the problem. And I think it's...
That is a lot of people who are somehow see themselves as citizens, who are citizens and see themselves as Americans, they don't recognize that this is a tremendous labor uprising by the poorest and the most oppressed workers, among many of them in the United States, particularly Latinos, and particularly these vast demonstrations of the last several weeks.
Yeah, and I think as workers we need to look at the whole situation, you know, what's even caused mass immigration, you know, since NAFTA came into effect in 94, there's been over 8 million Mexican families have fallen out of the middle class into poverty, and over 2 million Mexican families are now working below the minimum wage of $3.40 per day. So when people have to support their family, they're going to come to another place where there's jobs and they can have income to support their family. No one wants to leave their family and come to this country and work. But what we need to do as workers is support the movement for those people to have the same rights on the job as we do. And that is amnesty for these people working here. We constantly have the problems of... in my industry, of contractors exploiting these people, using them, putting up drywall at piece rate, and the piece rate ends up being they're not even making minimum wage, and intimidated to try to join the union because they're constantly scared of deportation. You know, we have to work together and make this part of the labor movement for these people to have equal rights in the workplace as we do.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, this fight about the legislation is important, but none of the things that are discussed in the legislation are in fact going to meet the needs of U.S. workers and workers who are immigrating here. It seems, you know, whether it's a guest worker program, which could be quite terrible, whether it's heavy enforcement, which couldn't work, although it will increase the number of police immensely, and a path to citizenship is a good idea, but none of that is going to deal with this, with the pressure on workers, both here and around the world. It seems to me you're trying to look at this as from that larger point of view, as part of the global, the social justice globalization struggle.
Well, it has to be a move. The labor movement now is under attack all over the world, and we need to look at and support the struggles in those other countries for unionization, in those countries where they face a lot more threats that we don't face anymore. Some people being assassinated in the attempt to organize unions in other countries. We have to look at the whole agenda of what's going on. It's a program of bringing wages down all over the world with the free trade agreements. But the solution you're hearing about, a guest worker program, isn't a real solution. This still ties the worker to the employer.
Jason, I'm afraid we're going to have to conclude. It's become 10 o'clock, unfortunately. Okay. Thanks a lot for talking to us, and I want to thank everybody on the show, Janice Thompson, Bob, Rob Ritchie, Jerry and Sis Levin. And Jason, the Benson Towers thing is on the 26th, and there's going to be constant, the anti-globalization struggle is still on in Portland, and we invite people to really get active with Jobs with Justice and PCAST. Thank you.
And thank you to the Old Mole Variety Hour. We move on now to the food show here on KBOO Portland. Don't forget that at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner says a military operation has already begun inside Iran and discusses what he calls the unprecedented revolt against Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld within the military. And here comes the food show, hosted by Kate Welch today.